This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Okay, fun new game, y'all. Forget the internal economic dialogues of one Janet Yellen. Try this one. What is Donald Trump thinking about this economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, April the 14th today. Good to have you along, as it always is. This is going to sound like I'm making it up, but I'm really not. The economic policy of the United States today, on a whole bunch of really significant levels, is substantively different than the economic policy of the United States was on those levels on Monday. We are going to make some sense of what's going on here and maybe why it's going on in the next 5 minutes of live radio. To do that, we've got Catherine Rampell here from The Washington Post, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine as well. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so let's run down the changes because I'm sure most people have heard of them, right? China is now not a currency manipulator, the president said this week. The Export-Import Bank is actually a good thing for the American economy. Janet Yellen, who the president accused of playing politics with interest rates, is now not so bad and might even keep her job. Catherine, why is this happening this week?
Well, I don't know why this week is different from all other weeks.
Very good.
Right,
very
thank you.
Good.
So some people out there will get that.
Yes. I
would say, though, that on some of these changes, they are for the good. I've never quite understood this derision for politicians who, quote unquote, flip-flop if the flop is the correct answer, right? I mean, like, so something like labeling China a currency manipulator. This has been a favorite talking point of Trump, of Democrats, of many Republicans as well for a while, except it's a completely outdated talking point. China, if anything, has been pushing up the value of its currency, not down more recently. So great if Trump recognizes that they're not doing the thing that he accused them, mistakenly accused them of doing before.
Do you think, Lee, that he is now getting actually accurate economic advice and counsel?
Well, it sounds like he's getting better advice. I mean, don't forget, you know, on the campaign, he just loves rabble-rousing, and that's what his campaign was built on. So a lot of these provocative statements are what won him so many, you know, what won him the election, this disruptor. Yeah. And now he's obviously getting educated, and as it turns out, is one of his favorite phrases, turns out healthcare is complicated. Turns out the Export-Importing Bank actually makes money. Turns out, you know, it's like the turns out president. It's just, you know, but I do think it means, you know, the former jargon for this was, though, my thinking has evolved.
Right,
you know, everybody's thinking evolved on gay marriage. But this is different. I think this is getting educated and finding the facts.
Right. He's actually learned something.
Yes.
Well, so,
which I would applaud.
Yeah, but it brings up a troubling question to have to ask about the president of the United States on economic policy. And I'll give it to you, Catherine, first, and you can duck if you want to. But here it is. Did he simply not know what he was talking about during the campaign?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, well, no ducking.
That's an easy question.
No ducking.
I think, well, look, I'm an opinion columnist. I'm allowed to have opinions.
That's right.
But I think that in this case, I may be entitled to my own opinions, but we all share the same facts, which is that Trump said a lot of things that were completely at odds with reality during the campaign, but they made nice slogans, you know, whether it was about being tough on China or draining the swamp or whatever, the swamp being something different from apparently what the rest of us thought it was.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that he said that were just not very well informed. And, he's no expert on all of the world's issues today, but I'm glad that he's learning some things. I hope that he's getting good advice on economic issues and otherwise so that he can continue to make more informed decisions than the kinds of positions that he espoused during the campaign.
So, Lee, go ahead.
No, I mean, this is the first president ever elected without political or military experience. And this is, you know, there's a lot you have to know. And so, you know, he needed Dennis Muilenburg, the CEO of Boeing, to explain to him what the export-import bank is and what it does. I mean, I think, you know, I think we're witnessing this education process as it's happening.
So that's the question, right? Because, you know, Obama and presidents before him have had these CEO councils and they've had advisory boards and meetings at the White House and yada, yada. And everybody looks at them and goes, yeah, nothing happens. These gatherings actually of CEOs, I mean, Mary Barr's been to the White House a zillion times and of GM and Elon Musk and bunches of people. He's actually getting advice and learning stuff from these things.
It's very true. You can have an impression. You can actually go in there and make an impression because there is it's like a, I don't want to say blank canvas, but I
like to think of him as being somewhat ideologically porous, that he tends to absorb the last piece of advice he seems to have gotten. And while, you know, it's great that on some of these issues, these CEOs are advising him and educating him in ways that maybe let him learn things that he did not know were the case in the past, whether it's about the Export-Import Bank or currency rates or whatever. I mean, you do have to worry, though, that these are outside advisors who come with an agenda, who have their own interests at stake. And it would be nice if there were people inside the White House who were just as well-read, just as well-informed on the issues, but didn't have as much of a dog in the fight. And that's what I'm worried about, that I'm glad that he's learning from smart people, successful people, but if he doesn't have the kind of base of knowledge to be able to identify when they're just giving him good advice and when they're giving him advice that helps their own company, that's troubling.
Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, well, there was no Wall Street today. Traders took the day off for Good Friday. Still, though, we will think of something to say when we do the numbers. This is going to be a long, long weekend for national security professionals covering the Asia-Pacific region. The North Koreans have promised more missile and bomb tests, possibly tomorrow, to mark a major national holiday. There's an American aircraft carrier battle group hanging around just in case. The Chinese have said, quote, storm clouds are gathering, end of quote, over the Korean Peninsula. All of which comes as President Trump has said and tweeted that he wants China to do more to control Pyongyang, presumably by tightening the trade and economic screws. How might that work? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Can China cut down further on its economic ties with North Korea, make life even more deprived and miserable to pressure leader Kim Jong-un? Foreign policy experts say it's a little hard to know because the North is so closed and opaque. But Lindsay Ford at the Asia Society says China clearly has a lot of leverage.
China is North Korea's primary economic lifeline. Now, North Korea has tried to diversify through a variety of illicit activities,
like counterfeiting, cybercrime, and arms trafficking, which Ford says helps fund the government and military. She says China could still do more to cut off trade and cash flows. Korea expert Jonathan Pollack at the Brookings Institution says China has already ratcheted up the pressure. It's complying more with international sanctions, and it's stopped taking one of North Korea's biggest exports, coal.
The Chinese, for the first time now, are actually making some noises about oil cutoffs, and that would hurt them a lot.
90% of North Korea's oil comes from China. A lot of food does, too.
Food could have consequences, although the North Korean economy, including agriculture, on the margins is doing somewhat better right now.
Political scientist Andrew Nathan at Columbia University isn't convinced more Chinese pressure would have much influence on North Korea's military leaders, who don't miss meals or oil deliveries.
They can hunker down and they have enough control over the rest of the population so they can, if necessary, you know, let them starve and the regime will still survive.
Using their counterfeiting and international arms dealing to keep the lights on. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've talked a lot on the program, especially since the recession, about how this economy is changing. Jobs and skills, trade, immigration, whole bunches of stuff. Here's one more thing, more about us as people in this economy than about the economy itself. Turns out for a bunch of not all that well understood reasons, we're moving a whole lot less than we used to. Moving as in picking up and finding a new place to live. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on an American economic mystery.
For hundreds of years, Americans have moved for work. The Gold Rush, the Great Migration, the pioneers, the colonists.
That was one of the ways you could get ahead in this country is moving to a part of the country that offered higher wages.
This is Daniel Shoag, who teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School. We still move for work or to find work.
The quality and the quantity of opportunities that became open to us simply by being in this region improved measurably.
Robin Schuster moved with her family a few years ago from San Diego, which she loved, by the way, to Chicago. She and her husband figured they'd have better chances of finding jobs in their fields, tech and higher education, and they were right.
The opportunity, the lower cost of living, everything improved. We would do it again in a heartbeat.
They might, but trouble is, a lot of us don't seem to be moving around as much as we used to.
Americans are much less mobile geographically than they were in the past.
Samuel Schulhofer-Wohl is a senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago.
In the early 1990s, about 3% of Americans moved between states every year. Now it's down to about 1.5%.
He argues we don't move around as much because, despite Robin's experience, sometimes there's not as much in it for us as there once was.
The benefits of moving have gotten smaller relative to what they were in the past. If you look across the country at the differences in the types of jobs that are available and in what you could get paid for doing a given job, those differences have gone down over time.
Shoag at Harvard says even if you can make more in New York, that doesn't mean you can afford to live there.
The places that offer higher incomes have gotten really expensive. Those gaps in housing prices have gotten a lot larger relative to the gains in income than they used to be.
Regulations, zoning rules, housing shortages have driven up rents in many high-growth areas. And you can guess who that hurts the most. Hint, it's not rich people.
People with a college education are still moving to the higher income parts of the country, and people without are moving away. And, you know, that's something that can increase inequality, limits opportunity.
But this decline in people moving geographically may be just the tip of the iceberg. It could be part of something much, much bigger.
It's just not as easy to change jobs or employment situations as it used to be.
Abigail Wozniak is Associate Professor of Economics at Notre Dame. She says, forget about changing jobs by moving. We just don't change jobs as much as we used to. For everything you hear about the gig economy, what Wozniak calls labor fluidity has declined 10 to 15% since the late 70s. She argues that's why geographic mobility is down.
Think of all the people you know. They took a job and they said, I'm going to do this for 2-3 years and then I'm going to change. And it's 5 or 10 years later, you know, or they left the labor force and they said, I'm going to come back in a couple years, and then they don't.
That right there worries economists.
A major source of wage growth is changing employers, moving between employment situations.
Why, though? Why we aren't changing jobs as much as we used to? That's a big mystery.
I wish I had a single clear answer to that.
It's not, she says, that we are all drastically happier with our jobs than we used to be. And she's looked at inequality, demographic change, labor market tightness, changes in compensation. Nothing seems to explain it. But Wozniak and her colleagues have noticed one thing that has declined along with labor fluidity and moving for a new job.
There's been a very pronounced decline in measures of social trust in the U.S. since the 1970s.
If you ask people if they think strangers are trustworthy, fewer people think so today than did 30 or 40 years ago. Maybe we just don't trust one another enough to hire new people or apply to work in new places as often. This is just a thought. When there are no clear answers, economists get really creative. But the bottom line is we really don't know why we aren't moving around and changing jobs as often as we used to. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have to do good work. We have to be as good as everybody else.
Takes more than prayers to market faith-based films. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets are closed today for Good Friday, but if you're getting your ducks in a row for an Easter egg hunt, a couple of numbers to help you out. Hard boil your eggs first. People, that means cook them for 10 to 12 minutes. Now the dye for each shade, 1 cup water, 1 teaspoon vinegar, combined with 20 drops food coloring, not 19, not 21, but 20. Give those boiled eggs a 5-minute color bath. Boom. Pretty eggs. Eggs are cheap this year, by the way. Lowest retail price in 20 years, adjusted for inflation. $1.32 a dozen. Average household consumes 4 to 5 dozen eggs at Easter, which seems like a lot. Biggest Easter egg hunt ever 10 years ago, Winter Haven, Florida. The White House not expected to beat that record at its Easter egg roll on Monday. That tradition, said to be something of a scramble this year, has been going on for 139 years. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And we want to know what you want to know
about business, technology, and culture.
Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And check us out wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. More than 33,000 people in this country died of opioid overdoses in 2015. There aren't any hard numbers on how many of those people were college students, but by most accounts, the presence of heroin and painkillers on campus isn't going down. So this week, the Clinton Foundation and Adapt Pharma said they would get together to provide 40,000 doses of Narcan nasal spray free to colleges in the United States. Narcan contains naloxone, which can reverse an overdose. Libby Denkman has more now on how colleges are trying to catch up on the crisis.
It's hard to gauge the scale of drug abuse on campuses. A lot of that information is private, but people talk.
We have had reports anecdotally as we talk to student groups of our students overdosing and dying on and around campus.
Lucas Hill is a professor with UT Austin's School of Pharmacy. He also directs Operation Naloxone, which trains students and community members to use drugs like Narcan to respond to overdoses. Hill says when the program launched last year, there was no blueprint for dealing with heroin and prescription drug abuse on campus.
We were finding our way through the dark here.
Now UT Austin stocks naloxone in every dorm, and resident advisors are trained to use it. Hill's team is working to expand the awareness and availability of naloxone and to become a model for other schools. Narcan costs schools about $37 per dose. And while it can bring a drug user back from the brink, it doesn't address addiction.
Colleges and universities, just higher ed in general, move slowly, and this disease does not.
Tim Raybould is with the Association for Recovery in Higher Education, a network of student-led recovery communities. He says being a college kid is stressful enough without battling addiction. Schools need to create the infrastructure to help.
Where that individual has support in academics and career development, where it's not just a cookie-cutter solution that's going to work for everyone because everyone's path is really different.
Raybould knows that path. He's in grad school at George Washington University. He's also a recovering addict. I'm Libby Denkman for Marketplace.
You know all that assorted detritus from your life that you just can't bring yourself to get rid of, but you also just can't find room for in your garage? If you're like a lot of Americans, you've stashed it all in one of those self-storage places. The catch, of course, is that there are ever-expanding piles of detritus, and so there are ever more of those self-storage places, which has prompted zoning restrictions on them in cities across the country, including, most recently, New York. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that one.
Yes, New York City has proposed tighter restrictions for self-storage buildings in industrial neighborhoods, but this isn't a cosmic message from city legislators telling you it's time to go through your old Little League trophies or Barbie doll collection. There's a bigger concern.
Well, that it's displacing industrial jobs.
Adam Friedman is director of the Pratt Center for Community Development. He says self-storage units are big cash cows.
They employ very few people. They have very low operating costs, so that they can pay a lot for land.
Pushing out manufacturing jobs, which is why Friedman says businesses in New York that want to offer new self-storage services would need a special permit, one that proves the building is no longer appropriate for manufacturing. And cities like Charleston, San Francisco, and Miami are following suit for their own reasons, cracking down on what they say is too much self-storage.
In Miami, the issue here, it's really just more of a visual issue.
Adam Gersten sits on the Planning and Zoning Board of Miami. He says new self-storage facilities are going up near his house and a bar he's opening.
When you're driving by a neighborhood and you see one or two interesting stores or restaurants, but then you see this sort of industrial monolith, you sort of second guess whether this is a spot you actually want to get out of your car and walk around in.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I don't like the look of Dunkin' Donuts everywhere. I don't like the look of Burger King everywhere.
Michael Humphrey is COO of SNL Construction in the Bronx. He develops self-storage buildings. He has a long list of all the jobs he says the storage industry creates, everything from real estate brokers to architects to those guys who inspect the fire sprinkler system. And he says they're not part-time jobs. Also, he says local businesses count on them to store merchandise.
I mean, if I could sit here for an hour and go to this, everything, time I thought of somebody that used self-storage, it could just go on forever.
But storage space critics say land use is an expression of a city's values. And the question we really need to ask is, what do we value more, space for our stuff or a good job? I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The Fate of the Furious, the eighth installment in the Fast and Furious franchise, opens today. Box office domination is widely anticipated. But on this Easter weekend, there is also a film for the faithful on more than 1,300 screens across the country. The Case for Christ, it's called. It's based on a best-selling book by author Lee Strobel. It was shot at a reported cost of $3 million. It's done $5 million so far at the box office. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at the market for and the marketing of religious movies.
Conversations about faith-based films pretty much always start here.
Adonai. Adonai.
Mel Gibson's 2004 The Passion of the Christ. Churchgoers pack theaters. The film made more than $600 million worldwide. It was the third highest grossing movie of the year in the U.S.
And once The Passion came out and did that kind of business, Hollywood was all over the idea of making films for this audience.
Chris Hansen is a film professor at Baylor University. He says studios and independent producers were also all over the grassroots, direct-to-congregations marketing strategies of The Passion.
Going to churches and saying, this is a film that your church needs to support, and churches were, you know, putting the posters up in their buildings.
According to Movie Guide, which tracks faith-based films, the number of movies with strong Christian content jumped from 16 back in 1996 to 67 last year. And as the market has become more competitive, so has the marketing. Richard Peluso is executive vice president at Affirm Films, Sony's faith-based arm.
We would joke a lot that, hey, you know, we're in marketing and it's not rocket science, but in some ways it can be rocket science.
He uses my new favorite word, lenticular, to describe marketing faith-friendly movies.
Lenticular marketing. So lenticular printing is, if you remember as a kid, you had a page that was covered in plastic, and when you held it one direction, it looked like one thing, and you held it another direction, and it looked like another.
Take the 2015 movie War Room.
Just because you argue a lot doesn't mean that you fight well.
Peluso's team marketed it as an uplifting family drama to some audiences, and in other materials, a movie about building a practice of prayer into everyday life.
You need to do your fighting in prayer.
As the market for faith-based films has become more saturated, there is still value in going directly to the pulpit, but that value seems to be shrinking. Baylor University's Chris Hansen says, for one, younger churchgoers crave authenticity in their sermons.
And helping to market Hollywood films doesn't come across very authentic.
And Chris Stone, the founder of Faith Driven Consumer, tells me pastors are also getting burned out.
Because there have been so many times that pastor has been approached.
He says they maybe have an hour for a church service, often timed down to the minute. So to show a movie trailer.
So are you going to give up your sermon time? Are you going to give up your praise and worship music time?
When a movie like The Case for Christ comes out now.
How can we even talk about historical evidence for the resurrection?
the marketing is extensive. There's a glossy study guide for church groups, posters, door hangers, customizable sermons. There's a social media campaign complete with Facebook art and shareable memes. There's messaging to the believer and the skeptic. There's an eventized premiere put on by a group called Fathom Events, which included a live Q&A with the director and talent, simulcast to theaters around the country. Brian Bird is the screenwriter and co-producer of The Case for Christ from the Christian studio PureFlix.
You know that whole big red part of the country? That's not a niche.
He's confident faith-based films like his will find their audience.
But it has to be good. We have to do good work. We have to be as good as everybody else.
Because, just like the rest of the movie industry, good word of mouth is the best marketing tool of them all. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Delta Airlines seems to be learning the public relations lesson better than United after that video from early last week. The Associated Press reports this afternoon that Delta supervisors are now authorized to offer almost $10,000, $9,950, to convince passengers to give up their seats on overbooked planes. My hand's going up at 10 grand. I'm sorry. All right, everybody, we are out of here. The markets were closed for Good Friday today. It was a down week, about 1% across the board. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitaran Yeves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.